minutes, and if everybody's nice and quiet and nobody sets anything on fire during the first show, show you another show. Mr. Shepard will be here at the conclusion of the television viewing. Now, we have to set a couple of ground rules, all right? Otherwise, we're all liable to end up in a slam. Like, no jumping up and down and yelling, and please try to keep at least a few aisles clear because of fire regulations. Okay, please? With this TV show, the important thing to remember is it's a show for your head. So I hope you enjoy it.
Appreciate the following program. Take your television set into the kitchen. Set it up in front of the open oven. Turn the oven up to 400 degrees. Make sure it's plenty hot. Squat down in front of it until you're well toasted. Then have your wife blow cigarette ashes in your eyes. Then you'll know what it's like.
Thank you.
back on some great thing that happened to you in your life, you don't remember it as a solitary, single, long thing. You just sort of remember bits like a voice, a room, the smell of something. It's all kind of like a mosaic, bits and pieces, kind of like some kind of tapestry. There's no sense to it. It's just there. And that's the way my steel mill life was. I can't really remember much else than just a lot of things, voices, people, smells, the taste of a sandwich, the sound of something breaking. It's the steel. First day that I walked in through the clock house, and I was all excited. I didn't know where to go, and there was a guy standing by the number one clock house who was handing out samples. It was 8 hour a day cut plug tobacco. Stores to buy yourself a new pair of safety shoes. And you have a whole selection of different kinds of safety shoes. You can get the sport model, you can get the full dress model, basic peasant model. And when you walk out of the stores with a new pair of safety shoes on, you feel 10 feet tall. I think getting a brand new hard hat issued to you. That's always a good feeling. You know, a nice, shiny, hard hat. And you take it back to where you're working and you figure out what you're going to paint on it. What kind of decals you're going to put on it. You know, this is a whole artistic expression of the inner man. And the smell of a new pair of safety goggles. Well, that's special thing to anyone who's ever smelled a new pair of safety goggles as he clamps them on his eyeballs for the first time. He knows what I'm talking about. You look through them for the first time and they're not scratched. Everything is clean and bright. That's the last time they'll be like that. 6 months later, you see the world like you're looking at it through a Brillo pad. Then that feeling when you get the envelope, that envelope that is so pregnant with promise, that represents all of your toil, that represents your lifeblood, the stuff that you have poured out on the floor of the blast furnace, the shipping dock, the strip mill, and it's such a little abstract thing. It's made out of paper. And yet, by George, it's your life. That's what it is, your life. Mm.
especially cold.
Or it's boiling hot, or there's a wind, or there's some searing blast hitting you, and the sound all around you. I think more than anything else, and I've never forgotten it, is the overwhelming, fantastic sea of sound. Each part of the mill has a spectacular difference from the part next to it. The coal strip, it almost looks the way it sounds. The coal strip. It's a long, dark building with a strange, mysterious blue light. And there's the smell. The mill is filled with a million strange, exotic smells. That the coal strip, for example, smells like an exotic oil. Natural sculpture. This is a beautiful natural sculpture. I remember I was coming down around the coke plant one night. This was at 4 o'clock in the morning. I was working the night shift, and I saw a scene I'll never forget. I was just trotting along. It was pitch black. When I see coming at me around the corner, way up, maybe a mile away, is this diesel engine. And it's towing a hot metal car. Now, a hot metal car is like a big thermos bottle. It's like a thermos bottle on wheels, and it's long. It looks like it's maybe 60, 7 feet long. And it tilts, and it's got a big opening on the top of it. And they pour molten steel into this thing, and it carries it from one mill to the other, molten. And so I'm running along with my bag. I'm sorting the mail, I'm looking down at the mail, and it's cold, the wind is blowing, and I see this diesel engine coming around the corner of a building. And right next to the track on the other side is a little weighing scale office. And so this train is coming right between them. And I could see the yellow light of the diesel just go, ooh, ooh, ooh. And he makes the corner. The engine did. And I see coming around the corner now is this hot metal car. And all of a sudden my mind says, he's tipping over. I can't believe it. He's tipping over. And as it tilted, this stuff started to pour out of the top of it. When I saw these two guys jump onto this diesel engine and run into the dark, and all the while this thing is slowly tilting over on its side, and then it settles down. It just laid down on its side, just boom. And that hot metal poured out of that thing. I just can't describe what it was like. It was like a tremendous tidal wave. Well, it rolled over this building, and there was a puff of white smoke, and that building was ionized. Zap. Well, it was one of those fantastic miracles, actually, that they had closed down this office something like 12 hours before, and there was nobody in it for the first time in years. And that place went up in a puff of white smoke. It took not more than maybe 30 seconds to dissolve it.
wild colors that you see in the mill are colors that I think are only probably the only place in your existence that you see colors like this are possibly the desert, possibly the Sahara at sunset or dawn. The reds and the greens. The one thing the desert doesn't have is the spectacular flames. As you begin to absorb this sensual feeling of the mill, the smells, the sound, these are things that cannot go on paintings. And they're all part of it. The feeling of the ground shaking beneath your feet. The cold. Moment when you take that 5 minutes off and you've been standing next to something that's so hot that it's cooked all the juices out of you and you're just sweating. You sit down and you open an ice cold Coke. I want to tell you that first big swallow of Coke is one of the great moments of all time. I mean, you can take sex, you can take it all. It's nothing compared to that instant.
Another bar through the mill now. How's it? Pretty good.
Okay, you're on the 179 now?
179.
Okay.
Water on, John?
Like coming into the clock house at dawn when you're punching in the day before your day off. It's a great feeling to know that tomorrow you're going to be off. And this is the last day of the week. Somehow the mill looks great on a day like that.
Got a hot bar here.
All right. Coming up.
All right. I'll have to put these switches, 250s on.
Next bar is going to have a little more acceleration, so we'll need a little more water.
computer, John. You're off computer. Switch off computer. Go to manual. Bill, dial in. You're all dialed in? Okay.
I was climbing up to the top of one of these one day on an outside steel ladder. And the ladder was made of perforated steps. You could look directly down, and you could see the ground below you. Well, I was rushing up this thing, and it had two metal railings on either side. And I ran up, and I was wearing safety shoes. And I remember it went ding, 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 ding. I used to run up this thing every day, just like a machine, like a monkey going up a stick. And I ran up the side of this blast furnace until I came to this tiny office, the little bitty office that I used to every day go in and get gas report readings that I would give this guy, and he would give me another mysterious brown envelope, and he sat there like a Buddha, high atop this fantastic machine, just looking out over the world through these grimy windows and his green safety glasses. He gave me his mail, and I stepped out of the door. And as I did, I was sorting my mail, which was a foolish thing to do. And I was on this high platform with the ladder going straight down, practically a vertical drop, roughly 90 feet below me was the ground. And I stepped out on that first step, and the wind screamed around the corner, and I was shuffling my mail, and I was so confident, I just started down, and the next thing I knew, it all happened so suddenly, I'm in midair. It's just as simple as that. I am falling. Just zip. My feet went out from under me. I saw my mail fly. Instinctively, my arms clamped down on the two rails on either side of me. I didn't even think that. Well, my body was swinging out over the abyss, and the guy who was working in the office came roaring out. He saw what happened. He saw me disappear out into the void. He came out like a shot. And I remember this fantastic power of this guy's hand. He grabbed me around the neck. He actually grabbed me by his hand right around the neck, and I couldn't breathe. He just grabbed me like a chicken. And he's holding out to me, and he pulled me in out of the screaming wind. And I remember the tremendous power of the pain that went through my body because I had dislocated both shoulders. I was really in pain. But he dragged me back in and sat me down, and he just looked at me. He said, that was a hell of a dumb thing to do. Is so filled with sound that mill people who work in the steel mill, most parts of the steel mill, get to be very good at lip reading. You'll find guys will have long conversations and never hear each other. That they'll be 15, 20 feet away in the middle of the open hearth with the noise so enormous that they just talk to each other and converse by shrugs. It's like a gigantic stool.
was a streak of molten metal. It just shot out through the darkness, out across this mill, and it began to flow. And there is no sight anywhere in all of industry. In fact, I would say very few sights anywhere in any kind of life that match that strange moment when the heat is tapped. Tapping the heat. It's one of the most exciting words in the mill. Metal just pours out, and there is no stopping. The minute that that heat is tapped, it just roars out. Lights up the whole place inside. This dark mill suddenly becomes as light as day, but it's a curious red, flickering white, screaming light. It's like the light of hell. And you see things, great shadows. Suddenly, you see one of the sites that steelworkers talk about all over the world. It's a universal steelworker site. It suddenly looms out of the darkness. The Phantom of the Open Hearth. The Phantom of the Open Hearth. A lady. A strange, mysterious lady. Staring out of that flickering orange-green flame. Looking down with slant, slit eyes. Inscrutable. The Phantom of the Open Hearth. It's a sight you never forget.
This is the first show of a 13-week series, and I think we'll let Gene Shepherd tell you about it. So here he is, Gene.
All right. I don't know what. I'll put this back over here. I'll put this on. All right. It is a commercial print. Now, before we... Now, at ease. I'll bust your ass, kid. Before we get underway here, I must say that I was out in the back there for a bit and listening to the, to what was going on the set here. And I have to agree with Lee that something happened to this equipment, because the sound we paid, in fact, probably the sound on the show, as you notice, there's a great deal of color and movement and all. And the sound, I think, is some of the best sound ever recorded on a television show. We spent a lot of time recording the sound, so you get the sound of the mill and all. And I might say one thing, every show is different from the one before it. And if you know, if you'd like to see another show later, would you like to?
Yes.
It's absolutely different in feeling. Every show is completely different, and the next one we have here, we have time to show it to you. I think you'll really dig it. Are you enjoying it so far?
Yes.
All right, now listen. If is there somebody in the back there? How about giving us a giving us some light so we can see the thing. Turn the lights on in here. I mean, no, they aren't. No, I'm sorry, they're not. Turn the lights on in the room here so we can see. Is this all the light you've got, this one little bulb here? My God, it's WOR all over again. We're a one bulb station. All right, I wish now for a while you guys would quit taking pictures and stuff, and we could carry on with this thing. Now, no, really, put your cameras down for a while and quit popping the bulbs. You know, I know one guy that doesn't even bring a camera; he just brings a thing that pops bulbs. Loves to have people look at him. And how many of you were here at the last year's press conference? I mean, that was... You still got your press cards? Well, as you can see on this one, we were much more careful about sending out cards. And if you recall the last time, there were kids climbing on the windows, or 68-year-old ladies that came in and said, "Where's my press card? I like it. The Pitcairn High School Journal." We had one hell of a time. Now, here's what I'd like to do, since this is, you know, supposed to be a press conference, and you know, it's very official. I'll give you a brief idea of what the show is. I think. Did you enjoy the show, first of all?
Yeah.
Well, I suspect. For one thing, the show is extremely personal, as you can tell, and every place we went, we tried to get on film and on tape. This was tape. We tried to get things that were more emotional and subjective. In other words, how the hell does it feel to be in Hawaii rather than what do the surfers look like? So we shot stuff in Hawaii. We were up in Alaska. We shot things in an Eskimo village inside the Arctic Circle. We came back and did a thing on the Great Plains in Montana. And it's, in fact, one of our best shows, I think, is The Mystique of Beer. The Beer Mystique. And you know what? The Beer Mystique involves everything from Tom Seaver, where would he be without Rheingold, to almost the whole ramifications of our time. So each show is different from the one before. That has to be remembered. In other words, the Steel show is one show, and the next show is so different that it's like another experience. In fact, I've felt for a long time that television is format, being drowned by formats. And so one Johnny Carson show looks almost exactly like the one before. Eternally, you go through time with Zsa Zsa Gabor sitting over there. And you can see the sparkly curtain. And eternally, there's the sound of Victor Borge off stage. It's as if nothing ever changes on television. Certainly the format doesn't. Now, I don't know quite how to do this. The last time we had people hand in questions when they came in. And I would like to have any of you who have a question, a legitimate question. I don't want any speeches. I want a question about anything. My radio work, my stuff I do for Playboy, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories. How many of you could forget that? Oh, God almighty. And by the way, for those of you who are curious, Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memory is part of a novel, which is actually, it's a collection of short stories, which is coming out in April, or August, Doubleday. It's called the Wanda Hickey's Night of Golden Memories and Other Disasters. And I think you'll recognize it. All right, here's what I want to do. Don't feel constrained to, you know, that you have to ask questions about TV. Anything that you dig. Now, as you can tell, a lot of work went in on the television show. I mean, these shows are take 6 or 7 months, each one of them, to create. It's a lot of work. And if you've got any questions about them, if you've got any questions about Playboy, what Hefner's really like, whatever you'd like to ask, raise your hand, and when I point to you, stand up and say your question out loud so everybody can hear it. So raise your hands, all of you that got questions. All right, the kid all the way in the back of the room by the wall.
Why did you choose this as your first show?
Well, what's that?
This is your first show here.
Yes.
Why?
Well, I'll tell you why, with the thinking that went behind it, because when you read Gene Shepard's America, I guess most people would assume it's a travelogue. They would think it's like Charles Perrault visits Pitcairn, Pennsylvania, which is the most dull, boring kind of crap I can think of. But Gene Shepard's America is a show that deals not with American cities or places, but with experiences. And I wanted to right away make it clear so that anybody who watches the first show that it is not going to be a travelogue. There's not going to be a scene of me sitting there, and over to our left is the Rocky Mountain Range. Over there is where the old lady's home is. You know, the usual stuff. And now we'll interview a colorful citizen of Pitcairn, Pennsylvania. The show is and certainly working in a steel mill, and I worked in one at 17, just about the age all you kids are. When I was in high school, I got a job there in the summertime. You heard me talking about it. Is really distinctly an American experience. Very few kids anywhere else in the world work in a steel mill at 17. And that's why I chose that show. I wanted to make sure everyone recognized from the start it was not a travelogue. Now, however, the next show is it's a completely different feeling. The next show is shot in Maine. It's about Maine and the whole mystique of Maine. If you've ever been to inland Maine on the Kennebec River in fall, you know that it's a whole new world. It has nothing to do with, say, Flatbush Avenue. I mean, it's about 20 million light years removed from Fordham Road. And one of the things that we wanted to do on the television show was to show things which are never seen on television, experiences in life. The steel mill is occasionally shown as a problem, or here is the mill. But actually, I don't think anybody's ever touched on how it feels to actually work in a steel mill. Most of you kids come from the Eastern Seaboard, and you don't know yet. You hear these terms, hard hat, you know, they use so glibly. And actually, very few of you would even be aware of what it's like, let's say, to work on the assembly line at, let's say, the Ford plant. What it really feels like, what the guy thinks about, how he feels. And you will agree that you probably saw a side of the steel mill that you've never seen in your life. You agree with that?
Yeah.
Well, that's, after all, it is educational television, and I feel that educational TV should educate. It shouldn't lecture, it should educate. So that's why we picked that show. Does that answer your question? Now, the other shows will deal with other places. Like, we go to Maui, for example. One of the most beautiful shows, I think, absolutely a beautiful show, is a show of a guy, me in this case, but it's just a guy, getting into a houseboat and traveling through the Everglades to an uninhabited island, and no words are spoken on the show. And you see nothing but... we shot it in the Everglades. You see nothing but pelicans and herons flying over him. And finally he gets to this uninhabited island in the Gulf, and he the first time he says something to you, he looks to the camera and says, "Well, I found it. So long." And he disappears into the undergrowth. a beautiful show. In short, it gives you an idea how it feels to live in the area of the Everglades and the Gulf and so on. So that's one show. Yes. Now let's pick a few others. How about the kid in the sweater standing up there, yeah, with the blue shirt? Yeah. Yeah, the work shirt. Yeah.
How do you manage to go on for years and years and still be as great as you are?
I've got talent. I mean, you ask a question, you're going to get an answer, kid. Yeah, over there, by the window. Yeah. What do I think of hot... Oh, man. The hotter the better. I'm waiting for girls to wear jock straps on the street. Oh, I ain't got nothing against them. Nothing like riding on the subway, you know, and seeing nothing but groovy scenery. All right. How do you feel about them?
Yeah.
You dig it, huh? Yeah. All right, how about, let's see, how about the guy over by the wall there? Yeah.
Have you ever gotten in touch with any of your old friends like Cliff or Morton? They love that song.
I wouldn't go near them bastards. No, I must tell you, as a writer, now may I make a point here? There was a Flick and there was a Bruner. And there is a Schwartz and so on. But remember that I'm a writer, and I work on the air as a writer, that these people are really composites. It's like asking Bill Cosby, you ever get in touch with Fat Albert? You know? Well, actually, Fat Albert is a figment of he's based on fact, but he's also based on imagination.
I understand, but don't they ever say, hey, there's Gene Shepard, I grew up with him.
No. No, because the names, to begin with, Schwartz was killed in the Korean War. If you read my book, In God We Trust, if you remember the last page, the guy says, it's too bad Schwartz couldn't be here. Do you remember that? Well, all right. But the point is that they were real people, but yes and no. I mean, after all, when a writer, it's like when Philip Roth is writing this Portnoy, for example. Is he writing about a real guy? Is he writing about himself? Yes, I think so. I think he's writing about a lot of things. But you wouldn't think of going up to let's say, to Melville and say, hey, do you ever run into Ahab these days? Well, there wasn't Ahab, probably. He poured all those things. And you know the interesting thing about it, may I say this? Wait, hold your hands down for a minute. That the more realistically you write, in other words, where people really believe in the characters, the more they refuse to accept that it's fiction. They begin to believe that this is not fiction writing. In fact, most critics in New York who read my work and see me, they really don't think Shepard deals in fiction. They think he deals in reminiscence. Well, my God, that's like thinking that all Norman Mailer wrote when he wrote, let's say, The Naked and the Dead, all he was writing was his memories of the war. You know, not so. He put them into a fictional form. And I think... Did you ever read Catcher in the Rye?
Yeah.
Well, now most people believe, you know, that they all, have you noticed all kids who read it identify with Holden Caulfield? They never identify with the fat kid with pimples in the shower. Even if there are fat kids with pimples and they're reading the book in a shower, you know, they don't identify with it. Which means, you see, that the better, I think, the more completely your style is integrated into the speech of your time, the more people tend to think that it's a guy just reminiscing. It's not really writing. Well, my work is fiction. In fact, my next piece in Playboy is about a boys' camp. Did you ever go to camp, any of you guys? Well, it's about a boys' camp called Camp Nawawawanaki. And it's about the Great War between the chipmunks and the beavers. You all were in camp. You know how they named the houses, beaver camp, the beaver lodge, and all that. Well, it's about a kid that lived in Mole Lodge. It's a real camp. I went to camp when I was a kid, but it's a composite of all things where in the ultimate moment they take this kid and they stick him down the hole in an outdoor gym. Which actually happened in the camp I was in. Terrible moment of truth. I'm sure the kid never outlived it, you know. Saw the world from another side entirely. All right, now wait. Is there a girl in the crowd who has a question?
Yeah.
Yeah, all right, baby. You sure did, baby. I'm waiting again. She says, I kissed you last year. Do I remember, honey? I did. For hours afterwards, I was walking circles. Yeah, I remember it. You want to try it again this year?
Don't tell her she gave her name out over the air.
Come on up. Now you see why showbiz is groovy, gang.
Wait.
All right, everybody ready now?
Get a picture. Make a bite. Okay, your friend's going to take a picture this year.
Okay. Oh, man. Kid here next to me says, you smug bastard. I mean, he's the Marty of Plainfield High. You know, he hasn't had a date in 8 years. All right, Eddie's. Now let's go on. That was great. Thank you. Yes, in the white shirt.
What do you want to accomplish by this
series? Stand up so they can hear you in the back. Fame and fortune. No, actually, what I hope to accomplish, now that's the kind of question that's almost impossible to answer, because when you do something, you know, it would be easy to come out with a glib answer. Well, I hope to give people a deeper insight into the world they live in, which is pure bullshit. No, I don't have any feeling about what you hope to accomplish. I hope people enjoy it. I hope they get something out of it. I hope the people who watch it get one-tenth as much fun out of watching it as we did out of doing it. I think today almost everybody almost everybody in the medium, whatever medium you're in, television, radio, writing, are cursed with the Messiah complex. Everybody feels he has a fantastic message that will change the lives of all the other less fortunate. And I say, well, I have yet to be convinced by anybody who's come on in a movie that I should change my way of life and thinking. I can't hear you. Stand up. Yes. Well, I'm going to say this to you. That's a theoretical and in many ways a question that doesn't really bear on what we did, because I don't think what I did could have been done on a commercial television network, not with the kind of free swinging, easy going. And it's not that it's controversial. You know, your entire form can be controversial. It's not what you say that's controversial. In fact, you can get on the Johnny Carson show and say the most outrageous quote, revolutionary statements, and that's not controversial. Form is controversial. So if I suggest to a network I want to do a show where I just go and shoot what I want to shoot and do things about my own thoughts, they'd say, are you out of your mind? I'd say, come on, who the hell are you? Now, if you're Bertrand Russell, they may let you do it early Sunday morning once. But in this case, I think that public television recognizes that TV as a form itself should be explored. New ways of doing things. Not just whether or not I'm, you know, making a pro-revolutionary or anti-revolutionary statement, which is not controversial. To me, those are just common statements that have been made for years. So I think also when you say the big networks, I say the big networks are only big now. I think that within a few years, and it's already happening, there's great numbers of people are going away from the 28th rerun of I Love Lucy. I mean, there are so many people that are no longer saying, well, I can hardly wait to see what Johnny Carson says to Zsa Zsa Gabor tonight. And so they're drifting over, and you see the great success of shows like Sesame Street, shows like even like Julia Child, which is very unusual. You ever see Julia Child? She always looks like she's about three quarters drunk. She's going, I'm going to hit this fish here, man. And it's great to watch her. You know, she's a female W.C. Fields. Well, they never put her on network TV because she's not pretty enough. So they go and they get the galloping gourmet who speaks in an English accent. And I say to you that by 1975, That will be, I think, the big network. And you notice they put my show on at 8 p.m. Sunday, which is prime time. Now, that would never happen on CBS or NBC. I don't care what I'm competing with. They're competing with me. I think the FBI is in trouble. I have the ego of an artist, and I should have. Yes. In the yellow shirt.
Well, what do you think of the comic book scene today? That they're more relevant, they didn't have a story to do?
Well, the comic book scene is deep thinking for the illiterate. I doubt very much. You say more relevant, but that's because you're not used to any other medium. I doubt whether you've read a novel in 5 years. And to me, all the stuff that comic books are saying is the same stuff I've been seeing on subway walls for years, which is my medium, really. I'm not putting down the comic book scene, but, you know, they're very predictable. The day that a comic book turns out... See, I think when you talk about predictability, I think that every comic book today recognizes that most kids believe that relevance means anti-whatever is going on. That's relevant. Well, that's an interesting feeling. You can become relevant very easily then. Just be against what's happening. And they feel it. And if you really believe it's that simple, then you're truly a comic book mind. Okay, I'm sure you don't. And that's why I'm saying it to you, if I didn't think you'd understand it. But I think the comic books are just one other medium. And by the way, if you recall, I wrote for Mad Magazine at one point. So you'll find me in the catalog of the Best of Mad. So I've been part of that scene. I was in the Mad Magazine. And you know that I've done stuff for National Lampoon. Have you seen that? So don't think I'm putting it down. I'm saying, though, that every medium has its validity in certain areas. There's not one that's better than others. They're all different. In the back there, yes. Have I heard of what the hell was all that? Sounds like a cure for acne. No, I'm not a rock fan. I know. No, I'm doing my own thing. I'm sure that the Beatles or the Stones don't sit around and listen to Shepherd. Huh? Oh, I don't know, but is it heard in New York? Well, I haven't heard it. Yeah, by the way, I don't do much listening. No, so don't think I'm out of it because I don't listen to the station. I'm merely saying that it's like believing that ball... Wait, hold your hands up a minute. It's like believing that ball players are always sitting in stadiums watching other guys play ball. In other words, the difference between a performer and a listener is a great difference. In other words, a performer is usually working very hard on his work. He doesn't spend his time when he's not working sitting there listening to more of it. You follow what I'm saying there? So you're a listener, and so you assume that what I do is sit and listen like you do. But that's... After all, you know, it takes... Do you know that it takes up to 10 hours to prepare my nightly show on WOR? So I'm not going to be sitting around listening to a high school radio station with kids saying, well, what I think they ought to do to J. Edgar Hoover is... Relevant, you know. Yes, the girl over here.
You had your very own copybook,
Spock
McDowell. What did you do with it?
Well, there are women and children here. Oh, I don't know. I've never seen the Partridge Owl. It's the Partridge Owl. The Partridge Owl. Thank you very much. I'd hold it up. That's what I'd do with it. I'll read it when I get back to the office. All right, now, at ease now. I want questions, not the gentleman in the rear there, yes. All the way by the door. Oh, well, may I say that almost every performer who gets dropped claims he's been censored. Because this is the easiest way. Now, I'm being very, very realistic. Remember, I'm a professional. And don't assume that what Shep... Now, wait. Don't stop laughing and listen. Don't assume that everybody who says things for public consumption is saying the truth merely because you happen to like it. You just accept that statement without even questioning. He was censored, and that's why he was dropped. It could very well be, and this is quite often the case within the industry, It could very well be that he was not drawing a sizable audience. It was, might have been a tiny audience. Furthermore, it could very well be that he was late a great deal of the time. I knew one performer who was actually dropped, a famous performer who was dropped, because the performer continually either didn't show up for shows, or when he did show up, he was drunk. Simple as that. And he was not... No, it was not John Gandy. No, I'm talking... Typical Jersey wit at its best. And it's a pristine wit. But I'm trying to make a serious statement here, and you know, I could be very easy. I could get a lot of popularity with all of you to go on and immediately say, yeah, he was censored, those rotten guys. But it's not that simple. And that in our industry, and I'm talking about as a performer, it is a recognized fact that most people believe that there is an I, or there is a they, that censors everybody on the air. That's a fact. We all believe this as much as we believe the earth is round. So the minute I'm dropped, it's a humiliating experience to be dropped. You've never heard a performer say, well, I was dropped because I was drunk all the time. Or do you hear one say, well, I was dropped because my rating was just a little bit below the Passaic police calls. No. He says, oh, and they censored me. If I had been allowed to say the beautiful things I wanted to say. And, you know, immediately thousands of people are in his corner, whether they've ever heard him or not, which is fascinating. That's happened on television. Now, I'm not saying... Now, you ask me, have I ever been censored? No. I have never honestly been censored. No one's ever told me... No, no, I was not fired at WOR because of censorship.
No, but you were censored.
No. Not censored at any point. Don't tell me what happened to me, kid.
I have an instance. It was on tape, as a matter of fact.
It was on tape, yes.
No. One of you showed him, the guy called in from Maine who had a serious...
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I was not censored. I cut it out myself.
Well,
censorship is not a matter is not a matter of, in fact, most censorship is highly overrated. That I feel that being censored is a thing that most people today exaggerate, like we exaggerate everything else in our time. I mean, we're living in the age of complete exaggeration. I mean, really. I mean, every movie that comes along, you hear the announcer say, once in a generation, man is privileged to see another great epic of his time. Christ. 2 weeks later, you can't remember it. And I'm just saying here that maybe Mr. Bennett was censored. I don't know. I'm saying, though, that I've heard that story said over and over again. I remember the Smothers Brothers. Do you know that when the Smothers Brothers were being taken off, they had dropped from first to something like 49th in the ratings? You notice they didn't complain of censorship the first year they were on when they were number one?
Yeah.
What happened? Well, they just suddenly start censoring? No. I think that often the word censorship is used. Maybe a guy can't face it himself. Very few people can face being dropped. Ron Swoboda will not admit that he was dropped because he was a 210 hitter. He always and now he's claiming that Tom Seaver was after him. How's that for paranoia? How about the kid in the back there? Yes, right there. Yeah. Yeah. Well, I was the character. If you remember on the road, there was a guy they were listening to all the time on the radio, and they keep referring to him as the angel-headed hippie. Do you recall the character?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I knew Kerouac, and yeah, that's me, for what good it is. I should have thought reading the novel you would have seen right away. You see, in those days I was on all night. I was on from midnight to 5 on WOR. And I'd just come from the Midwest. Over there by the wall, yes.
What attracts you to subways as opposed to taxi cabs? Money.
Well, for one thing, you probably get the wildest company in the world when you sit on the subway. It's not the cheapness, no, not at all. I can afford cabs, but what I dig in the subway is, for one thing, they're a hell of a lot quicker generally in New York. In other words, if you spend much time in Manhattan, you realize to get by cab from, say, 40th Street, where WOR is right down here, to 14th Street, often takes you hours. You walk out, you get in the subway, and zap, you're there in 5 minutes. Do you live in Manhattan? Well, then, if you lived in Manhattan, you'd realize the truth of what I'm saying, that the subway system is infinitely faster than cabs. If you're interested in really getting where you want to go, you take the subway. If you're, you know, a lady type and you like to ride cabs, you take a cab. Yes, the pink shirt here. No, 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 the guy here in front of you. You'll, we'll get to you later, yes. Yes.
What time do you think the show should be on? We carry it on an FM college station in Lowell, Massachusetts, and we're having debates what time it should go on.
That's a good question. I kind of think that my show, the attitude of my show, is better in the evening and late, because at the time I'm on, it requires people to sort of give, you know, of their imagination, just let it go. It's very hard to do that at 2 in the afternoon when you've got all kinds of things coming up later and you're thinking of, you know, at 6 o'clock I've got to go in for this thing and all that. I would say about 10:30 is the best time for my show. The other part of your question is, what was that? I think
you try to have just a few commercials.
Oh, do I try to have just a few commercials? Well, yes, actually. In fact, WOR has in my contract that I have the right to refuse or accept commercials. And I have that absolute total right. Before a commercial goes on, they ask me whether I want it or not. And they're not, at that hour, they're not interested in, you know, in having a lot of commercials. It's you know, it's there, but they're not making an issue of it. And I do have the right to drop or accept commercials. I'm surprised nobody's asking anything about the Playboy or the TV show or anything else. You know? How about over by the fireplace?
When were you in BITG Camp Crowder?
When was I? I was never at Camp Crowder. No. I was in several camps, but I was never at Crowder, actually. I don't know where that rumor got out. Your dad, probably. Every place I go, there's a guy who says, well, I know him in Pitcairn, Pennsylvania. No, I'm sorry. Let's see. Where's... How about the kid way in the corner over there with a groovy hat? Yeah.
You've mentioned sort of what you see as a cultural now.
I can't hear you. You got to really belt it out. I have? Yeah. I can't really hear you well. You say, what's the closest in Europe or what? No, I'm sorry. I'm not trying to be funny. I just can't hear you. You say, I've mentioned the cultural malaise. That exists today. Yes, go on. I suppose, no, I never said that. No, I think there's always been to the intellectual, and he's generally wrong, unfortunately, about this, a cultural malaise. In other words, no matter what time in history, everybody believes who's an intellectual that they're living in the worst time in the world. Just a fact. Well, there was different things going on. In the village, I live in the village now, by the way. I live on 10th Street, so it's not that I've left the village. So I know the village quite well, and I just say the thing has changed. What has changed is that Cosmopolitan has made it popular. In other words, it's a very hip thing now for all kids to come and be in the village. Now, that's a sad mistake on their part. They think if they go to the village, they will become talented, or they will become hip, or they will become with it, and the poor idiots wander around, you know, with their mouths hanging open. They would be much better off standing in front of the Dairy Queen in Pitcairn, Idaho. But the village now has become a kind of a catch place for all the people who feel they're looking for an identification. In other words, they do it with their clothes. They figure if they wear groovy clothes, they then become hip. If they go to the right place, they'll do it. And the village is just a piece of real estate. And you walk around the village, and I think some of the saddest sights in America are seen walking up and down McDougal Street. We really believe they're with it, you know. You can see the glazed eye of a guy who really should be on Fordham Road. That's where he... All right, now wait. Any girls here again? Girls have been very quiet. Yes, over here. I'm always talking about Syrian Dagwood, she says, yes. I always do that. I talk all the time about Syrian Dagwood. I did once, yes.
What are they made of?
Syrian Dagwoods are a total obscenity. As I said on my show, they're much faster than X-Lax. Much more thorough. The Syrian Dagwood is a very hot meatball sandwich that is of Syrian origin, which is particularly made in Maine. You find Syrian Dagwoods in places like Waterville, Maine. And you have to drink a lot of beer to counteract them. Now, how about in the front here? We'll let a couple of you guys get in. Yeah, okay. Stand up so they can hear you.
If you think you do have talent, you know, and your brother-in-law doesn't...
He says, if you think you do have talent, why don't you say it so they can hear
it? Your brother-in-law isn't the editor of Playboy or something like that.
Yes.
Just get into the Reading Field.
You feel that my brother-in-law is the editor of Playboy.
Well, I think you have talent.
No. The only thing... sit down, kid. You've shot me. See, every kid feels that he's got the real talent and all the others that are doing it have a little facility. But the only way you can find out if you have talent is to do what you think you've got talent in. If you think you're a writer, you better start writing, kid.
How about if you already have written it?
Well, if they've sent it back, you better reevaluate whether or not you have talent.
Where do you send it to?
Well, you submit it to various editors, just like all of us do. I did it, Philip Roth did it, Norman Mailer did it. When you write, you send in your manuscript to the fiction editor of whatever magazine that you're going to try to write for, and either they accept it or they don't. They do not accept it because they're your friends.
Do you rewrite pieces for people?
Do I rewrite?
Yeah.
From what?
Pieces for people.
No, I do not rewrite pieces for people. He thinks he's got talent. He wants me to rewrite a piece for him. You laid it out there for real that time, kid. No, I do not. Yes, over there.
I'm from the Partridge Owl. Thank you, Googling God.
The Partridge Owl? You'd like to know what?
God.
Huh?
You believe in God.
Do I believe in God? Now, there's a question. There's no way to answer that. You know, that people have been asking that question for 20,000 years. Now, come on, let me finish this. It's a serious question, and I'm saying that people alternately believe in something, and they alternately disbelieve in something, depending on what's happening to them in their life. In short, I could say to you that if all of a sudden the guy runs out of an alley and he starts shooting at you, you suddenly begin to at least hope there's something. Now, I'm trying to say to you that a belief in God is not as clean-cut as a belief that, let's say, today is Thursday or tomorrow is Friday. It's not as clean-cut with me, and I don't think it's ever been with anybody. Some of the great literature has been written on that theme, so to ask me if I believe in God, that's impossible to answer. Do you?
Well, you know, sort of.
Well, that's what I said. Okay, sort of. That's the trouble. You know, the Pope is going through that, too. I mean, this is all men do. Oh, over there, yes.
Are you eternal?
Am I eternal? Eternal? Yes, I am. I have just received, I'm sorry, am I eternal? You bet your goddamn ass I am.
Yeah.
I, okay. All right, see, that's a secret society of total slobs, of which I'm a member. Hey, wait a minute, before we go any further, are you guys enjoying this?
Yeah!
All right. And by the way, I'd like to point out, may I make one thing, you know, that you guys may not, maybe you're aware of it, but a lot of people in the other mediums are not. For example, people who are, you know, I'm talking about really serious adult types in radio stations and in magazines, really seriously believe that the only thing anybody under 20 is interested in is rock. Now, I'm not saying that most people under 20 aren't, but what they're really saying is that they would never listen to anybody talk.
which is quite obviously not true. In other words, you're interested in many things, and I just say that that's one of the strange things that's happened in our time. Ever since, if it ain't rock, it ain't, you know, the kids ain't with it, you know, forget it. Paul Krasner does not play a guitar, and yet you all dig it. Yeah, how about the guy with the hat? Let's get him. He's a real exhibitionist, yes. What's that? How did I get started? Well, do you want to really know, or do you want me to make a funny about it? Well, here's how I got started. I'll tell you, it was funny. Well, I don't think. Now, I'm going to say something here that a lot of guys in my industry would get bugged at. If you'd noticed that every time you hear an actor or an actress or a writer on any of the shows talk about how they got started, you'd believe that it was like they got the call, priesthood. At the age of two, they were doing Hamlet. Well, I've never found this true in real life, and I think most people's careers, even though they may seem to you to be very exotic careers, generally sort of happen to them. And in my case, I was a high school football player. I was a defensive back on a high school football team. And now listen, you want to hear how I got started? You'll hear it. And I was playing, and at the same time, I had an amateur radio station on a ham. And that became known in school, and they wrote about it in the school paper. And one day, in my junior year as a football player, I got a call. A guy came to see me, and he was from, he was from the local radio station. He was a faculty member of my high school, and he said, "We have a high school radio show that goes on every Saturday from 10 until noon, 10 a.m. till noon. And part of that radio show is a sportscast about what happened, you know, last night. We had played all Friday night football games, what happened last night in the various games." And he said, "Would you like to do it? Since you have a ham station, you probably know how to, you know, deal with the microphones on." So I started to do it, and I had a tremendous amount of fun out of it. You know, the day after the game, I would come in and give scores and all that. And then a few months went by, and the program director of the station asked me if I would like to have my own show. And here I was, you know, 16. I had my own radio show on a commercial radio station. It was a fantastic thrill. And after that, I became an actor. I went into acting, and I did a lot of teenage acting on various shows, like on Jack Armstrong and stuff like that. And actually, I started as an actor more than anything else. Does that answer your question? Okay. So it was an accident. I did not have a dream at the age of five that I was going to go on the radio. And by the way, I was never a radio listener during my teenage life. I think there's two kinds of kids. I think there's the kid that sits in front of the TV set, or he reads incessantly, or he's always a watcher. Then there's the other kid that's the doer. Well, one kid is sitting there in front of the set watching. There's another kid out playing second base. And I happen to be the second baseman. I was not a watcher. I never listened to the radio hardly at all. Yes, here.
Have you ever been a victim of crime living in the village?
Have I ever been a victim of crime living in the village? Well, that in itself is in a way being a victim of crime. However, I have to say, yes, I had an automobile stolen. I've had my apartment robbed twice in New York. Yes, I think anybody who's lived in this town at any length of time has had something happen to him. And yes, I have been a victim of crime.
What kind of
indeed.
Car?
What kind of car? At that time, it was a Mustang Fastback. Luckily, they didn't steal my Morgan Plus 4, which they didn't know how to turn on even. Yes, in the pink shirt over there.
You said that you had any trouble with WOR. What about the night of August 16th, 1956?
Where were you? I did not say that. I didn't say I didn't have any trouble. I said I was never censored. Now, be honest what I said. No. When I was let go at WOR, I was let go because they had planned to put an all-night WPAT music show on in place of me, just segued music. And that was at the time when WPAT and, you know, all that Montavani type stuff was real big, and they wanted to take me off, and it was a tremendous uproar about it. But it had nothing to do with censorship. I don't care what the New York Times said. They were wrong. I was not censored. I did not give a commercial that was not on the log. This was later written up, but it was not true. Yes?
How come John came into your place that night in the middle of your program?
Well, because they had to bring somebody in, and John was at the station at that time.
You just terminated. Why was it in the middle of your show?
Well, because I had been ordered that night to play nothing but music. They were converting it to music, and I didn't. And so finally I said, okay, that's it, friend. But it was nothing to do with censorship. Now, I'm not trying to cover up for a while. I'm trying to make the record straight. That there is a belief today that there's always an evil they looking over everybody saying, now look, you're going to write this, you're not going to write that. I'm sorry, I've never really found it. Yes, over here, over in the corner. Come on, stand up, you with the blue shirt.
Every once in a while, you ask some questions of the way you...
Yes.
People really call up and answer.
Yeah.
No, those are all my voices. Nobody calls up.
Yeah, what about...
No, as a matter of fact, may I say that he asked a question. He says, once in a while I ask a question on the air that's a rhetorical question, and I say, somebody call in and give this answer. Yes, they do, as a matter of fact. That's the one thing that I have trouble with at WR, because what happens, we've only got one woman on the switchboard at 10 o'clock at night, and when you get 700 calls, she flips, especially since she's always watching TV down there. And that's the actual truth. Yes, they do call in. Those are not fake calls at all. Over here in the brown shirt.
Since you're writing for Playboy now, how do you feel about the quote-unquote Playboy philosophy?
Well, I've been writing for Playboy now for 5 years, so... as far as I'm concerned, Playboy is a magazine. Now, you know what a magazine means. The word magazine really means a gathering of many viewpoints. It is a magazine, which means that I think this is to Playboy's credit, that they don't have to dig a guy's philosophy to print him if they think he has something to say. And conversely, if you don't believe in the Playboy philosophy, that does not stop you from writing. In short, I think the Playboy philosophy, as a matter of fact, around the magazine, it's called Hef's Coloring Book. Around the magazine, it's not taken very seriously, but it is among readers. And I never even read it. I find it so crashingly dull that I just don't read it. Does that answer your question? What's that? It's about as new as Noah's clay. What? Okay. That's a secret Syrian password. Over here.
I understand you majored in psychology in college. Am I correct in assuming that?
Yes.
Do you consider yourself to be a Skinnerian, a Freudian, or a Neo-Freudian?
I consider myself to be Shepherd. And in fact, that's why I found psychology a little disturbing, because you have to fall into a category. You have to believe a whole system of beliefs. In a sense, you've even said it. It's like, do you believe in God? And the guy says, yeah. Well, all right, do you consider yourself a Methodist, a Protestant? Are you a... In other words, the dogmatic feeling within every school of these things bothered me completely, because I didn't buy it. I thought some people were right in certain areas and some were wrong. I consider myself a pragmatist. and I think that Mr. Freud, who lived in the 19th century, by the way, are you listening? I think that Mr. Freud, for example, and most of the seminal people who deal in psychology were late 19th century, early 20th century. I think they couldn't conceivably have understood some of the traumatic experiences that you and I feel. For example, I think one of the great traumatic experiences in every guy's life, especially if he's a male and he's 16, is he buys this used car he's been dreaming about for years, and he goes out and buys it, and 10 minutes later discovers that it's got a balsa wood transmission. Well, Freud wouldn't have known about that. You'll remember that car all your life. You may not remember the first girl you knew. Now, how about somebody in the back, the girl, all the kids? I can't hear you, honey. The hat on the poster, that's a good question. That represents, it runs through many of the shows. In fact, if you guys are willing to sit by and see the next show, would you like to see the next show?
Yeah.
Well, you'll see that hat. That hat is a theme that runs through many of the shows. Not all of them, but many. And it's a sort of an identifying characteristic. You see what I mean? It's there. Did you like the poster?
No.
You didn't? All right.
Wait, you said, what about the people that...
The tube was through.
Well, you know how much that poster cost, Brenda, to print? $1.63 each. That's just to print it. And now, wait a minute. Put your hands down. I mean, he brought up a point. That poster, when we, that was not, by the way, to be, that poster was not for the public. That poster was to be distributed to, come on, sit down. You're disturbing everybody. That poster was to be distributed to the various television stations that were carrying the show. It was not as a souvenir for you. Now, let me finish. When it came out, the thing cost around $1.63 to produce. That, we didn't realize it would cost that much. It did. If you've ever had any of that type of printing done, you'll know we're not kidding on that kind of stock. Well, a lot of people saw it who were around Boston who happened to see the thing put up, and they said, geez, they'd love to have one. So we got the idea of making them available to people. Well, if we charged you what that poster actually cost us to mail and to print, it would be around $3.50, $4. I can only say I'm sorry, honey. If you expected something that lit up in the dark and had gold tassels on it for a buck, you're just way out of it. Now, I did say we were going to send it to mailing tube. And you know why we couldn't do that? We discovered that the quantity of letters, we expected about 1,500 answers. In other words, do you know what work there is rolling up a poster and putting it into a mailing tube and mailing it out is like? We thought we'd get about 1,500 replies. As of this afternoon, we have received just a little over 8,000. There was no way to do it. We were just inundated. So we either had to say, all right, we'll send your dollar back, forget it, friend, or send it out the best way we could. Yes? Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
And even at that, we lose, the station, WGBH, loses roughly $1.25 on every one they mail to you.
Who pays for it?
WGBH does.
We're not
yes.
from Jersey, and we're from Lakeland. And does the Mark and Dean show a preview of the show?
No. Was the Martha Dean's show a preview of the
show? When you did the thing about Maui?
No. No, she was. He asked me, was the show I did on the Martha Dean show, she had me as a guest talking about Maui, was that a preview of the show? No, not really. Because, you know, when you're dealing with a visual image and all, you can't really put it in words. How could I tell you what the steel mill was like better than those pictures? I mean, did you see that? By the way, did you see that fantastic shot of that strange face in the open heart?
That's a mess.
No, it is not. As a matter of fact, this thing, see, here's the smart ass here. There's always one who come early and sits down and, by the way, makes a total ass of himself. No, it was not a mask. As a matter of fact, this open hearth creature, to my knowledge, has never been filmed. And as all steel workers all over the world are familiar with that phenomenon. It's this strange character that comes out of the dark in the open hearth, I thought was one of the most dramatic things I've ever seen on TV as part of the world. Did you ever see anything quite like it? And that's absolutely authentic. And every time out of the dark, when that thing would come, when they tap the heat, man, it's something else. And yes, standing there, I'll have to get rid of you. You're just causing trouble all around you. Go ahead. What type of media do I think I'm best at? Well, I'm best in the bathtub with this fantastic rubber duck I've got. No, I don't make any. To me, media are all the same. I don't find one better than the other. Now, you probably like me better on radio. That's because you're more familiar with me on radio. We tend to drift towards the familiar all the time, and. Many people will say that my best medium is on the stage in a college. In fact, I've had a lot of people say, I couldn't stand your radio show, and I came to see you at Princeton, and man, it was unbelievable, or something like that. So if you only know a guy in one medium, and that's another problem we have today, that everybody's segmented. We don't really believe if a guy does radio, he can conceivably do television well. And if he does television, he certainly can't be a stage actor. And this is a profound belief on the part of critics and others, and I say it's totally missing the point of an artist. It's like saying that simply because Picasso does oils, he can't conceivably ever do ceramics. And in that field, they don't have the kind of hang-ups that we have in the media. Yes, the girl over there.
Could you give us some examples of traditional Slav art that you talked about a lot?
Well, I would, but you know, you're asking me to start kind of do a show here, and I additional. Well, I think I give a lot of it on the show, you know. Well, now one of the great examples of Slav art has been several of the questions today. I mean, this is called subconscious. I'm a smartass type of Slav art, you know. The critic goes, "Hey, Shepard, if your brother ain't the editor of Playboy, how do you get in?" Well, he's been working all week on that ad lib, you know. That's Slav art. He's growing up in the footsteps of his old man, who, you know, hangs out in the subway and says, "Oh, for Christ's sake, the president is an idiot. All he has to do is blah, blah," you know. The instant solving of all problems and the complete belief in your total ignorance. Anybody in the back? Because all you guys have been getting called on the front here. How about the kid in the yellow jacket? No, I didn't. I was out of town most of the time. I have not had a chance to go to the auto show. I'm sorry. Well, I just didn't have a chance. The auto show didn't come and see me either. I mean, I got my own show to work on. You know, that's another thing that I must point out. You know, when you're hold your hand down for a minute. When you're doing, you must stop and think for a minute. I'm doing a nightly radio show, which takes me 5 to 10 hours to create before I can do it. We've been working on a television show for a year now, and I mean, I'm going to Boston tomorrow to film more of it. I've just finished a short story for Playboy, which took me 4 months to write, and you expect me to go and look at the new Mustang? No, I'm just saying that you just can't do it all, you know? Although I do enjoy the automobile show. You do too, don't you? How about way in the back? Yeah. I can't hear you. Who are you speaking for? I become more disenchanted with it? No, I haven't, no. I mean, you're putting words into my mouth. If I were disenchanted with it, I wouldn't. What the hell? I enjoy radio, as a matter of fact. I think radio is a damn good medium, and I don't think many people have used it well. I think most people think of it as a place where you play records, and I think that's really selling it down the road. Yes, the girl here. What was that? She says, "How long will your series of columns be running in Car and Driver? Are you a Car and Driver reader?" Thank you. Do you like the magazine? It's a very interesting magazine, isn't it? Well, I'm a regular columnist for Car and Driver, and as long as I have the time to do it, I'll do it. Right now, my contract holds with them. It will be really a total of a year, which means I have another 6 or 7 columns to go. But they asked me if I want to, you know, do it regularly, and I don't know. It depends on time. Do you enjoy the columns? Would I take another kiss? Yes, later, but in the other room. Be dirty, kid. You're proving that, yes.
I'm an apprentice.
All right. You don't have that look. You have the look of Oscar Wilde in your eye.
Thank you.
Now you ask for it. I'm hoping you'll trap. You're dealing with a pro. All right, all the way in the back there. Yes, way in the back. Well, I don't think, you know, I just don't think any set of experiences that you have in your life affect you much more than any others. In other words, you're asking me a question, how do they affect me? Well, I'll tell you, for one thing, it gave me a hell of a lot more tolerance for people than I had before I went in. And when you're thrown in with a lot of people who you wouldn't even have as friends in many cases, you begin to see a lot about life when you're in a situation like that. It affected me in many ways. It made me implacably anti-war, for one thing. But that's only one thing. It did a lot of good things for me. I think one thing, it took me out of the self-pitying thing, which most of us have. You only do the thing you want to do, and you always feel that people are after you. And it did good things and bad things for me. But I don't think anybody can go through an experience as complete as the Army without having some kind of change come about in his viewpoint as a result of it. And it's not as simple as people who've never gone through it believe. It's a complex change. Well, now listen, it's getting kind of late. Are you guys enjoying this press conference? You know, I mean, I'm trying to answer as truthfully as I can. Now, wait, all of you who have had questions answered, please keep your hands down, because you look, I've seen the press card. What do you want? Do you want to give it to me? You want to ask me a question? Yeah, go ahead.
I don't know if you've read the
Greg's Well, stand up.
I don't know if you've read the Greg's Abroad, but you are a traveler, and where would you suggest that you start off going in the world when you visit a country?
That's a good question. He says, "Where would, if you want to be a traveler, where would you go first in the country, you know, in the world?" Well, I would say Ireland. Now, that's an unpopular answer, but I'll tell you this. If you start by traveling, if you start in your world of traveling and you go to a place like Ireland, the one great thing about it is that they speak your language, and it's just a total experience. And on the other hand, if you start in a place... See, you're asking my opinion, all right? I don't care what's going on. It's nothing to do with whether there's a problem going on there or not, because you ask me what country, and I'm telling you that I feel that the great start for a traveler, if you want to learn how to really travel, if you love the idea of traveling, you ought to take a car and go drive up along the coast from, say, a place like Limerick, and drive up to Dublin and spend about a week in Dublin just fooling around. And after that, you're already beginning to be a traveler. Most people go to the obvious places. They go to Paris, or they go to India, or they go to France. These are the obvious places. You'll send me a postcard. Well, you send me a postcard from Galway, and I'll know you made it. Because I just love Ireland as a place to travel. It's great. Tremendous experience. I loved it. And I made friends in Ireland from my first visit that I took to Ireland, that I still have. It's a tremendous place for that. If you like people, you'll love Ireland. Simple as that. How about the girl over here on the left? I think you could explain it better than I could. I don't do the show for kids. In other words, I'm doing a show. My show is not done for young people particularly. But I think you enjoy my humor, I think, more than anything else. Do you agree with that?
Yeah.
And I'm not trying to be egotistical or not, but I'm just saying that for some reason or other, my kind of humor appeals to a certain kind of person. You'll find that 80-year-old ladies will laugh, too. It's a certain kind of guy. And I just don't put teenagers... You know, today we put teenagers in a separate nationality. It's like youth is a separate nationality. It's not a phase through which you pass. It's a nationality, like Greek and Belgian. A lot of kids really believe that their nationality is youth. They have a youth passport. And it's just no such thing. Nothing is worse than to see Ringo Starr waking up on his 38th birthday. And he is. All the way back by the Venetian blind. At the last count, 17. No, WOR. You ask how many WOR listeners? That's a good question, and I'll tell you. At the hour that I'm on, according to the most... There's no way to know, actually, after all, you know. How can you tell? Because millions of people or hundreds or thousands will be listening in cars at that hour. You know, we cover 27 states at the time I'm on. I get mail from places as widely dispersed as, say, Italy. Guys listen to me in Italy. Did you know that? I get letters from I got letters from places like Switzerland. Now, at that hour, they figured in our primary area, my listening audience varies between roughly 800,000 and 1.9 million. Well, now wait, that's not as much. Now wait, that sounds like a lot. It is a lot. But remember, we're covering, that's in 27 states. Now wait a minute. Now don't quit. You ask me a question, I'm telling you the actual fact. Now you may not like it. You may be, because most people who listen to me feel that they're part of a tiny minority. Almost all letters I get say to me, "Well, you know, Shep, none of my other friends listen, but you're my friend," kind of thing. In fact, whenever I do a show in a college, and, you know, 2,000 people show up, there's always five guys who show up after the show, and they come up to me and they say, "Hey, Shep, who are all these phonies?" So he's the only listener, see. But we do have a hell of a listening audience at that hour, and that's a powerful medium, WR. Yes, that's right. That's right. That's quite right. Thought he'd get a laugh, but he was right. God, you can't win any, can you, kid? How about the guy way back there? Yeah. Right there. Yes. Yeah.
Well, those kids
lose. Wait, I can't hear that. Who said that? Well, I don't think the Times knows much about humor. I've read the paper. I think humor, yes, in a way, I'd have to agree with that, because I think today that most people's ego gets in the way of being funny. That as people become more self-involved and they become more egotistical, it becomes less possible to be humorous. Because any good humorist, good, has to first be able to laugh at himself. And I cannot imagine Joan Baez laughing at herself. Ain't no way to think of the average kid in this crowd here laughing at himself. Most kids can't. They really believe that they're the beautiful ones and it's the evil ones that are after them. Which kills humor. There's no way to have humor that way. And I do think, in that respect, humor is dying, but I don't think it's dead. I think that it's a phase through which we pass through these phases of ego trips and so on. And who knows, but in the next couple of years, I found that actually in some ways it's coming back. I think that it was dead about 5 years ago, but I think there's been a great trend returning to humor. Because I don't think, wait a minute, I don't think the 12 and 13-year-old kids take them nearly as seriously themselves as the 15 and 16s now did when they were 12. Sure, I think that the society's always changing. And that behind all of you, there's an 8-year-old kid who thinks you're really an old fud and you're out of it. You kids, you think you're youth, but there's somebody behind you who thinks you're already out. So I don't know. Yes, over there by the wall, in the glasses.
Do you think that a radio or television actor should be forced to join a union?
Well, that's a question I don't know. I'm not competent to answer that. Do I think that a radio or television actor should be forced to join a union to get on the air? I'm not competent to answer that. And I don't think you are either.
Are you in the union?
I'm in the union, yes. As a matter of fact, I'm of two minds about that, because if you didn't have a union, man, they'd have you working for nothing all your life. If you prefer that, fine. But that's what happens in this business. Now, it's getting... How about... Now, wait a minute. Now, just... All right. Which one of you is the most worthy of being answered right now? Oh! 8 guys jump up with tears in their eyes. How about the kid with the glasses right there? Yeah. And the striped shirt.
Last, you've mentioned before that you think that board of the evil.
No, I didn't say that, but I'll accept that part. Yes.
Strikes last spring could have been caused by board rather than.
Well, now you're asking me to give a black... Did you hear what he said back there?
No.
Well, he said that I have said on the air that I believe that boredom is at the root of much of our social unrest and problems. And do I think that the strikes last summer, did you say? Last spring were caused by boredom? I think partially. See, boredom, like any other answer, is not just simple an answer. You can't say boredom caused it, but I think it certainly plays a role. I think one of the problems you have to face in a society where, in a society, where you kids can pretty much get anything you want when you want it. I mean, you turn on the television set and there's a movie. It's free. You walk out and you turn on a radio, you get records free. So the natural result is ultimate boredom. That everything is too easy. There's not much of an effort to getting anything. And so boredom begins to really be a real rock down in your soul. You begin to say, oh God, what am I going to do? I'm really bored. And that can be a dangerous thing. I think boredom is probably as dangerous as anything we know. And I'm not talking about specific boredom, like going to a show and being bored. I'm talking about just general boredom, what we call a malaise that settles down on people. All right, now wait a minute. I've got some written questions, and I'm going to take care of them. This one here is from somebody from Hunter College. It says, discuss the writing, production, and direction of your TV series. Now, this is the first time anybody's really asked a question about it. That's, again, a very large question. But the team that produced the show consisted of four people. Now, come on, kids, really. It consisted of four people. The overall idea of the show, how the show should be, and the way the show is, was an original idea that I personally had. Now, that's only an idea, but to put it together, you have to have people who can work with you. It's just like direction and production all are part of the thing. And so we created a team of people who understood what we were trying to do, and all four of us have worked together for over a year intimately producing this sound, the whole picture. Now, I don't know whether he's here now. The director who's worked with me is here, I think. Is all right. And we worked together on this thing, so there's no thing that Fred direct and I didn't direct. In other words, we would go through a scene, and both of us decide what we want, and we'd work all day on the damn thing. So the team is a four-man team of Fred Barzyk, who's the director, myself, who is the, you might say, the creator, writer, performer, the guy that came up with the idea, and the two production, the associate producers who brought together a lot of the mechanical problems. In other words, the people who provided the music and did all this. For example, Lee Brown. Well, hey, Lee was responsible for all the music on the show. She actually made the decisions on what we would use. And in this particular show, did you notice the quiet music behind the scenes in the steel mill? This is a very subtle art, and Lee is very good at it.
Is she really Patty
Vermaelen? No. In fact, no, not at all. She works for me. Her daughter is back there standing next to her. She's bigger than you are. This is Lee Brown. Lee, raise your hand so they can all see who you are. Lee is the producer on my radio show. And the associate. Now, wait a minute. Standing next to her is her daughter, Elizabeth. So, Liz, put your hand up. There's Liz, who she goes to Clifton High School. Fred Barzyk. Fred, come on, put your hand up. Fred is our director on the show. And we have lived together and worked together for the past year. We've been all over the world. This is Fred Barzyk back there. Wave your hand, Fred. There's our director. And with him, I hope, is the other associate producer who handles all problems like transportation and logistics and all that. And in fact, traveled ahead of us in many cases. Both Lee and Olivia did, and they would pre-survey. For example, Olivia and Lee traveled ahead of us into the Rockies by themselves, into ghost towns, to see what was there before we even went out there. Lee, for example, was in an Eskimo village, fog-bound one night all by herself, traveling ahead of us on the Alaskan series. And here's the other associate producer who worked together with us. It's a four-man team. It's Olivia Taplin from WGBH. Would you raise your hand, Olivia? Well, they can't see you back in the corner, honey. There ain't nobody can see you there. So if you'll get out here with Lee so they can see who the hell you are. This is Olivia Taplin, and so the four of us produced the show, which, by the way, by television standards, is a minute, minuscule proof. And we wanted it that way. When we decided to go out, it was not a matter of budget, because we had a budget by the Ford Foundation, which was good, but we decided, like a good movie crew, that the smaller, the more compact the crew, the more cohesive the product would be. We didn't want 1,500 guys going off. And that's our core group. That's it. Will there be more? Oh, yes. This is a 13-week series. Yes. In fact, we had a meeting. He asked me, will there be more? We had a meeting with PBS yesterday, and it looks very good that the series will be expanded even next year. Now, I want to say this. I want to say this. You guys, a lot is dependent on you, really. You know, the trouble with television and radio is that most people only get exercised about something. They really get bugged about something when it's gone. You know, if all the people who wanted to keep the Smothers Brothers on the air had written about the Smothers Brothers when it was on the air, it probably wouldn't have gone off.
What about Star Trek that all the people that wrote?
That's not enough out of a 15 million audience. In other words, when you're dealing with a national show, it's just like, you know, it's like out of the city of New York. If you have a 14 million population and 15 guys write, that's not much. Now, they may be very involved, but the thing is, you have to appreciate a thing while it's there. So if you guys get a chance to watch the show, which will be on Easter Sunday, that's this Sunday at 8, and you dig it. Now, I'm not saying you have to dig it, really. If you dig it, if you enjoy it, if you want to see more, for God's sakes, please write Channel 13 and tell them that. Don't just sit out there, you know, dumb and say, oh, groovy, and go wandering off to the Dairy Queen. And then 6 months later, you wonder what the hell happened to the show. This is what people do all the time. We're always doing things after the fact. Wait a minute. I have to answer these questions. We've got a lot of great questions on paper here, and most of you kids are waving your hand, and I want to answer. Here's one. Was your show influenced by the one Henry Morgan did on WR? No. I had never heard Henry Morgan at all when I was in radio. He was not carried where I was growing up out in the Midwest. I never heard Henry Morgan, and so I couldn't honestly say it was. I don't know who asked the question, but Henry Morgan did not influence me at any point. It has been rumored that your head thumping is electronically synthesized. Would you disprove this rumor for us? All right. Which is the PA mic? Is this it? Sit down. I'll show you how my head works. Listen. If you think this is easy, try it once. Now listen carefully. All right, let's hear it. What do I think of New Jersey? New Jersey is the Garden State. Oh, there's nothing like driving along Route 22 at twilight. And ahead of you, you can see the Pat Boone hamburger heaven approaching.
Bellini Tower of Pisa.
And you can see those mountains, the Watchung Mountains behind, covered with doggy doo-doo. All right. I happen to think New Jersey is a very exciting state. I love Jersey. There's a warm feeling the minute I get out of the Holland Tunnel, you know, and I see all that crud drifting down, bouncing off the hood of the car. It's my home. It's my people. And I see that big sign that says, "Welcome to beautiful Union City." That's guts. Oh, yeah. It says, would you do us the honor of appearing at the Jersey Hills Frisbee Conference Championship? later this spring to throw out the game frisbee. That ain't a bad idea. That's from Art Dreyfuss, the captain of the Mountain High School frisbee team of West Orange. All right, when the affair is about to happen, send me a letter well in advance because I want to get my arm in shape, you know. Well, you better send it to me by mail. I can't answer that right now. I may be out of town. After this TV show goes on, I may have to get out, you know. All right, what type of rig did you use as a ham? Well, I'm still am a ham. And my call is K2ORS. And I'm on 20-meter single sideband, and I'm using a Drake TR-4 into a Gonset 3 linear. Okay? All right. Now, shush, it says... Here's a good question. It says, at the last press conference last year, we asked you about how you felt about the drug problem. Do you feel that things have improved or gotten worse in the past year? Well, the very fact that nobody here has already asked me loudly about the drug problem says something that I have felt for at least a year, that the drug crisis is on the way down rapidly among younger kids. I think there was a group of kids at one point who went into the drug thing and they got involved in it, and they're going to still be involved most of them all their lives. And I think that the kids, it's just like smoking. I think most of you kids are turned off of smoking. Well, that wasn't true of kids 10 years ago. Now, I think at this point, I think most kids are hip enough now to know that the drug scene is not the groovy scene that, you know, the older kids think. And I just don't think the problem is as great as it was among younger kids. Now, I may be, it's very, very strong among kids over 15 yet. But I think they're from a previous group of kids. See, we tend to think kids is all one big lump, and I don't believe that. I just simply don't. I see a guy standing back there laughing loudly, but I'll tell you this, among police, they find the same thing, that a few years ago, it was very common to find 10 and 12-year-old kids. Now, of course, I'm saying that in different social conditions, what I have said is not true. In other words, I suspect that among many minorities, who are really, you know, who really have problems, personal and social problems, the drug problem is still as great. But I'm talking among the kind of kids that we have here today, for one reason or another, that most of them, I don't think, are as hip to drugs as the same group would have been had you talked to them, you know, the same age group 4 or 5 years ago. Do you generally agree with that?
Talking about pot.
I'm talking about drugs, and I include pot too, yes. You disagree? Fine. That's your opinion, but I was asked. And I think this is what I feel. And in fact, you even see a lot of people are taking second thoughts about the pot problem. You see, did you see the piece recently in the Post of the pharmacopsychologist, a famous scientist out in the West Coast, who last year had been advocating legalizing pot? He's been studying it for a year, and he says, no, he absolutely does not buy it now. He says it does have permanent problems and permanent damage, he believes, as a scientist. We're always asking a cop or a priest or a pothead about what drug is about. You should ask the chemists and scientists. Maybe they tell you something. Here's another question. This is a good question, by the way. And I'm sorry that I can't tell you a popular answer. Most of you would like me to say, yeah, pot's groovy. You know, yeah. It ain't that simple. I don't know what this is about. I'll meet you at the Horn and Hard, that's funny, at 46th Street. It says, here's a question. This is from Bogota High School, the official paper, Bogota, all right. Do you plan to break with WR in order to join WGBH? No. It had nothing to do with each other. It says, I noticed this press conference is WGBH function as opposed to WO function. No, they're neither. As you notice, most of the questions today were about WOR. And I'm not leaving one to join the other. I'm doing a series, and I'm going into television full blast, and I will continue to be in TV, because I came to New York as a television performer, not radio.
What did you do?
I had a television show for a long time before I came to New York. Did you think that I just suddenly appeared in New York? But... I'm not leaving WOR to go on TV because I think both mediums are very valuable, but they're very different.
says, what type of plane do you fly? Well, I fly several types, most consistently a Cherokee 180. I also fly occasionally a 172 Cessna and from time to time a Musketeer Mark III. Okay? It says, what airport? Well, I fly to several airports. It says, when is your daily show on in Boston? Well, the daily show is on, not on WGBH-TV, it's on WGBH-FM. I do not have a daily television show in Boston TV. It was a series that we did, a short series last year, but a special series, not a regular evening show. I'm on WGBH-FM, I believe, at 11 p.m. every night. 11 o'clock? It says, do or did you smoke cigarettes? No, I was lucky. I never got involved in cigarettes. I never really did. So I honestly can't say I gave up smoking. It says, how do you feel about smoking? Well, it's never been a thing in my life, so I don't have no... Obviously, the medical opinion is that it's not good, so that's all I can say. If you know those things, you do it. What's that? Somebody say something? Somebody turned around. They're looking for the bartender downstairs. By the way, how many of you have never been in the Overseas Press Club before? You know that this is one of the most famous rooms in New York that you're in right now. That's why we had it here. Because we thought you might enjoy seeing this. This is the room that many things have happened that you've read about later in the paper. This is the room where most of the official people, ranging all the way from the late Pandit Nehru to people like Winston Churchill and so on, this is the very room, right like it is now, where these people gave press conferences. And we're holding it here because we thought you'd dig seeing it. It's really a historic room. And this is where it really happened. So you'll see in a lot of newspapers that say, in a statement at the Overseas Press Club, X so-and-so said today, well, this is where it was made, right here, before the New York Press. And we just thought you'd enjoy seeing it. It is a fascinating place, isn't it? Anybody else here? I should answer a couple more written questions. It says, reports have it... I don't have any idea what this is. It says, reports have it that Charles Kuralt, on his way out of Pitcairn, Pennsylvania, charged publicly that your show was a cheap gimmick to get you more well-known as a prelude to an impending presidential campaign. Thank you, my friends. Well, God damn it, I hope it didn't get out this soon. So, yes, I am running for the presidency in 72. All right. My God, I'm convinced. All right. What's that? All right.
Chance with the 18-year-old vote.
It says, here, let me see. What has become of my kid brother? Well, he's still my kid brother. And he's living in Hammond, Indiana, and he's working for the Borden Dairy Company, okay? Isn't that a dull answer? All right. Most of these questions are deteriorating rapidly here. It's getting to be nothing but silliness. And so, now wait a minute. On that point, I have to ask you a serious question now. First of all, do you think... Have you enjoyed the press conference so far? Yeah. Now, would you like to make this a yearly affair?
Yeah.
Now, one other question, and I want you to think about it seriously. It is now 6:10.
I'm hungry.
Kid, you have the look of a guy who's been hungry since you just hit the ground. He hit the ground hollering for you. All right, and his mother just... the other question I have to ask is this. It's 6:10. I want you to think about it seriously. Would you like to see the second show?
Yeah.
Or would you... Now, wait. Now, think about it. Or would you prefer to watch it on Channel 13 the way it really should be seen, with good sound? I'm afraid the sound... The kid behind the cabinet over there, the one that's really afraid. Put your hand up.
Yes.
All right, you.
Well,
I made a mistake. I asked a bummer of a question. Thank you for coming, and I hope you dug it. Thank you.